Hello, and welcome to the September IASB Update Podcast. My name is Neely Shaw, and I am the Executive Technical Director at the IASB. As always, I'm here with the Chair of the IASB, Andreas Barco. Thanks for joining us, Andreas.
My pleasure, Neely.
We are here to share with you the highlights from our September IASB meetings. This meeting, we discussed a range of topics from financial instruments to extractive activities. We also have some important developments on our ongoing post-implementation reviews, which we will discuss towards the end of today's podcast. That said, let's begin with the latest updates from our research projects. This month, we discussed three projects: goodwill and impairment, equity method, and extractives. Andreas, could you start us off with goodwill and impairment? We had quite a milestone decision in September, didn't we?
That's right. But just to build the suspense, let me give you a bit of history and context for the decision. As part of the IASB's goodwill and impairment project, the IASB has been considering how to improve the disclosure requirements about business combinations. And back in 2020, the IASB published a discussion paper which suggested adding some new requirements to our business combination standard IFRS 3. In particular, we decided to require entities to disclose information to help investors assess the subsequent performance of business combinations and quantitative information about expected synergies. As you would expect, the IASB heard conflicting views on these ideas. Investors, on the one hand, said the information is needed and will be helpful. Preparers, on the other, were very concerned about the cost of disclosing that information, particularly information that they consider to be commercially sensitive or proprietary information. In the last few meetings, the IASB has been discussing how to proceed, and at this meeting, the IASB has tentatively decided on a package of disclosure requirements that it thinks is a reasonable balance between the needs of users and the concerns of preparers. The IASB tentatively decided to proceed with requiring entities to disclose information about the subsequent performance of business combinations and quantitative information about the expected synergies. However, and to respond to concerns about the cost of disclosing that information, the IASB tentatively decided to do things. First, to exempt an entity from disclosing some of the information in specific circumstances. If the entity decides not to disclose the information that would otherwise be required, it would be required to explain why it didn't do so. The exemption would be designed to address concerns that some of the information that would be disclosed could be commercially sensitive and could cause harm to the entity and its investors. The IASB is going to discuss some additional application guidance it could provide to help make that exemption operational and auditable in practice. And then secondly, to address concerns about the volume of disclosures and the associated cost of complying with the proposed requirements, the IASB tentatively decided to require information about the subsequent performance of business combinations to be disclosed for only a subset of business combinations. The IASB tentatively decided to require the subsequent performance information for only what it terms strategically important business combinations. So that's a new term. Strategically important business combinations would be identified using a small list of thresholds specified by the IASB. If a business combination meets any of those thresholds, the entity will be required to disclose information about the business combination. The thresholds will be both quantitative, for example, based on a comparison of the relative revenue, operating profit, gross assets of the acquirer in the acquired business, and qualitative, based on the wording in IFRS 5 used to identify discontinued operations. The IASB tentatively decided that the benefits of the amended package of disclosure requirements outweighs the cost of disclosing that information. So that's the first of the three research projects. Really great advancements.
Thank you, Andreas. It is really exciting to see all of that work come together in this decision. So let's move on to our second research project, which is the equity method project. And just to remind our listeners, this project is exploring whether we can address application questions on the equity method of accounting by identifying and explaining principles in IAS 28. So this is not a fundamental reconsideration of the equity method of accounting or the definition of significant influence or the scope of IAS 28. Now, in past board meetings, The IASB has decided on 7 categories of application questions that it would explore. And at this meeting, the board continued its discussions on the first category of application questions, which are those related to changes in an investor's interest while retaining significant influence. So for example, if the company has a 40% interest in an investee, an increase to 45% or a decrease to 35%, how would you account for that? Back in June, the board tentatively decided for increases, the company would apply a cost accumulation approach. And the question for September was how to handle disposals. At the moment, the board had a very fulsome discussion and has asked the staff to go back and do some further research about what to do, whether to sort of mirror the application of the cost accumulation approach for acquisitions or to take a different approach. So stay tuned for more on that project. So that was the first set of, or the first category of questions that the IASB has addressed in September. The second category of questions that the board addressed related to transactions between an investor and associates. Specifically, the staff introduced the application question on the perceived inconsistency between the requirements in IFRS 10 and IAS 28. On how an investor recognizes gains and losses that arise from the sale of a subsidiary to an associate. So let's move on now to our third and final research project that was discussed in September, and that is on extractive activities. To remind our listeners, this project is focused on improvements to the disclosure requirements for exploration and evaluation expenditures and activities, as well as the removal of the temporary status of IFRS 6. Is a little bit of further background, the IASB had considered whether to develop new recognition and measurement criteria in IFRS 6. Part of the reason is that there is diversity in accounting policies. However, investors said that they could manage this and that they were more interested in improved disclosures. And so for that reason, the project's focus is on improving disclosures. This month, the IASB discussed findings from the first phase of this project, disclosure suggestions, and a plan for further research on developing requirements or guidance to improve the disclosures in IFRS 6. As a next step, the staff will conduct limited outreach on the findings from phase one, focusing on improvements to disclosures about accounting policies on E&E expenditures, cumulative E&E expenditures to help comparison of extractive activities, and information about risks and uncertainties. And what the staff will try to do is understand user needs, why they're not getting the information that they need, and the cost of providing that information. So that wraps up the research projects that were discussed in September. Andreas, could I hand over to you to start us off with standard setting projects and in particular primary financial statements?
Okay, thank you, Nili, I'm happy to. Listeners will be interested to know that the IASB discussed proposals relating to 6 topics covering all 3 aspects of this project to enhance transparency and comparability through requirements to present defined subtotals, improve disaggregation, and disclosures about management performance measures. So let's look at these in turn. First, the IASB tentatively decided that it will not proceed with any specific requirements for disclosures of unusual income and expenses as part of this project. We looked at this several times, but couldn't make the proposal operational. So therefore we decided to put it to rest for the moment, but that doesn't mean that we get rid of the unusual classification completely because it is in part linked to our disaggregation proposals and to the requirements around management performance measures. Second, related to the disaggregation of operating expenses, the IASB tentatively decided to provide application guidance to clarify the function and nature of expense methods and to withdraw the proposed prohibition on a mixed presentation of operating expenses. The IASB also tentatively decided to require an entity that presents functional line items to disclose a narrative description of what types of expenses, based on their nature, are included in each functional line item and to require an entity to include in cost of sales the carrying amount of inventories recognized as an expense during the period when presenting cost of sales. With regard to subtotals in the statement of profit or loss, we made 3 tentative decisions. Firstly, We decided to require an entity with specified main business activities, entities that invest or provide financing to customers as a main business activity, to classify in the investing category income and expenses from associates and joint ventures accounting for using the equity method. Second, the ISB tentatively decided to clarify how an entity should classify income and expenses from investments in subsidiaries, associates, and joint ventures in separate financial statements. And thirdly, the ISB decided to withdraw the proposed requirement in the exposure draft for an entity to classify incremental expenses in the investing category. And lastly, related to management performance measures, we decided tentatively to confirm the proposal that specified subtotals are not management performance measures, and to specify that if a management performance measure is reconciled to a specified subtotal that is not presented in the statement of profit or loss, an entity is required to reconcile that specified subtotal to a subtotal presented in the statement of profit or loss. So I think that really concludes the majority or the big decision making sections in our PFS project. So another big advancement that we did in September.
Absolutely. It's really another exciting milestone. I think the next step for the PFS project is to conduct some outreach to test some of the decisions that the board has made tentatively that differ from the proposals in the exposure draft. But just to manage expectations, even though most of the big decisions are made, there are still quite a few smaller decisions just kind of wrapping up the project that'll take a while to conclude. So our expectation is that deliberations will continue through the end of 2023 and we'll proceed from there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So moving on to the next standard setting activity discussed in September, rate regulated activities. The ISB discussed the interaction between IFRIC 12 and the ISB's proposals in its draft standard on rate regulated activities. And the ISB decided that an entity would first apply IFRIC 12 and then apply the requirements of the draft standard to any remaining rights and obligations to determine if the entity has regulatory assets or liabilities. So Andreas, shall we move on to financial instruments?
Oh, absolutely. My favorite topic. So bless you.
Thank you.
So let's start with financial instruments with characteristics of equity, or as we call it, FIIs. The ISB continued its discussions on a long-standing practice issue, namely the accounting for financial instruments containing obligations for a company to redeem its own equity instruments, including written puts and non-controlling interests. The ISB tentatively decided to propose amendments to IAS 32 to clarify that paragraph 23 applies also to obligations settled in a variable number of a different type of the entity's own equity instruments, and to clarify that the accounting on initial recognition of the obligation to redeem an entity's own equity instruments, if the entity does not already have access to the returns associated with an ownership interest. If the obligation involves non-controlling interests, the debit entry is recognized against a component of equity other than non-controlling interests. In the case of an entity's other obligations to purchase its own shares, the debit entry is recognized against a component of equity other than issued share capital. We also tentatively decided that on expiry of a written put option on an entity's own equity instruments, the financial liability is reclassified to the same component of equity as that from which it was reclassified on initial recognition, and that the cumulative amount in retained earnings related to remeasuring the financial liability could be reclassified to another component of equity, but is not reversed in profit or loss. The ISB also tentatively decided to clarify that written put options and forward purchase contracts on a company's own equity instruments are required to be presented gross instead of net to align the accounting with other obligations that are conditional on events beyond the entity's control and to assist users on financial statements to assess the company's exposure to liquidity risk. Nili, whilst we are on financial instruments, do you want to let our listeners know what we decided about contractual cash flow characteristics coming out of the post-implementation review of IFRS 9?
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, Andreas, this project has arisen from the classification and measurement post-implementation review of IFRS 9. And the IASB decided to work immediately on this project because this is viewed as a fast emerging area where clarification could really be beneficial. And part of the project will help, we hope, address questions around the measurement of ESG-linked financial assets. So in September, the IASB decided to clarify that for contractual cash flows of a financial asset to be SPPI, there should not be variability in the contractual cash flows that are unrelated to the borrower or the time value of money. In addition, contractual cash flows that would be consistent with SPPI include the following characteristics. One, the contractual cash flows that could arise from any contingent events are SPPI in all circumstances. Two, the contingent event is specific to the borrower. Three, the timing and amount of any variability in the contractual cash flows are determinable and specified in the contract. And four, the contractual cash flows arising from the contingent event do not represent an investment in the borrower or exposure to the performance of any underlying asset. The IASB also decided to include examples to illustrate the application of these principles to financial assets with ESG-linked features. Also at this meeting, the IASB discussed financial assets with non-recourse features and contractually linked instruments, or CLIs. The IASB decided to amend IFRS 9 to clarify that a financial asset with non-recourse features exposes the lender to the performance risk of the underlying assets throughout the life of the instrument, both for the payment of the contractual payments as well as in default, and restrict the lender's contractual right to receive contractual payments over the life of the instrument to the cash flows generated by the underlying asset. To help assess contractual cash flow characteristics of financial assets with non-recourse features, the IASB also decided on examples of relevant factors that the entity could consider, such as the legal or capital structure of the borrower, the extent to which the expected cash flows from the underlying assets exceed the contractual cash flows of the financial asset, or whether there are other sources of finance or loans that are subordinated to the loan from the lender. The IASB also decided that unique features of a structure of CLIs are the use of multiple CLIs, the presence of non-recourse features, the prioritization of payments through a waterfall payment structure, and concentrations of credit risk that disproportionately reduce contractual rights in the event of a cash flow shortfall. And finally, the IASB also decided to clarify that the underlying pool of instruments can include financial instruments that are not entirely in the scope of IFRS 9, such as lease receivables, as long as they have cash flows that are similar to payments of principal and interest. So that concludes the board's discussions on standard setting projects. We have two further topics to discuss before we wrap up this recording. The first is maintenance and consistent applications. And as I promised, the second is post-implementation reviews. Andreas, would you like to start us off on the first one?
Yeah, happy to. So on the maintenance and consistent application topic, a key takeaway from the session was that the IASB considered the Interpretations Committee's June 2022 discussions, as well as respondents' comments on the submission about cash received via electronic transfer as settlement for a financial asset. The IASB decided to explore narrow scope standard setting as part of its PIR on IFRS 9. Now, I shall point out the emphasis is on the word explore. The first question is whether we can find a narrow scope solution that would reduce the cost of applying the general recognition and derecognition requirements in IFRS 9, including the cost of changing current practices to comply with these requirements in accounting for payments an entity makes or receives as settlements for financial assets or financial liabilities. And whether the solution would not significantly reduce the usefulness of the information that would result for the requirements. So it is really an exploratory stage, but we don't want to make any commitments at this stage that we will be changing the standard, but we decided we want to give it a look and to be mindful of the concerns that have been flagged to the committee and the board.
Thank you, Andreas. So let's move on to the final topic of post-implementation reviews. As a starting point, the ISB discussed some clarifications to the description of post-implementation reviews, specifically the objective, process, and outcome of PARs. And the reason that the ISB had this discussion is threefold. One, it became apparent to us over the course of the last few PARs that as we've learned more, we've been articulating the description of PARs a little bit differently, and that's caused some different understandings in practice. Two, because we have so many PARs that are now starting up, we wanted to make sure that we are describing them consistently. And three, in the course of conducting and finalizing the agenda consultation and setting out the board's priorities for the next 5 years, it became apparent that we also needed a prioritization framework for issues that arise out of PIRs, how to prioritize those issues in light of the priorities and the resource demands, both internally and externally, coming out of the agenda consultation. So the staff shared with the board the updated version of post-implementation reviews. This description has also been discussed with the Due Process Oversight Committee of the Trustees, and very shortly will be posted on our website. Going specifically to PIRs that are in progress, the board discussed further, as we talked about earlier, the post-implementation review on the classification and measurement requirements of IFRS 9. Specifically, the ISB discussed six matters raised in the feedback about how entities apply requirements not specifically covered in the request for information. Of the six matters raised, the ISB decided not to take any further action on any of the matters, although for one of the matters, that is purchased or originated credit impaired financial assets, the board decided that it would be considered in the upcoming phase of the PIR and IFRS 9, which covers impairment requirements. In addition to that, the board heard from the staff about the post-implementation review of IFRS 15 on revenue from contracts with customers. The staff presented the objective, activities, and anticipated timeline for the first phase of this project. And the plan right now is that the board would publish a request for information in the first half of 2023. And then finally, the board discussed the timing of the post-implementation reviews of IFRS 16 on leases and on the hedge accounting requirements in IFRS 9. The board decided not to start either of these PIRs at the moment, primarily due to the need for more evidence of how these standards or how these requirements are working in practice. But we will revisit this question about when to start the PIRs again in half two 2023. So that concludes our very full September discussions. But before we wrap up, we should share that earlier this month, the ISB published the exposure draft third edition of the IFRS for SMEs accounting standards, achieving another important milestone, this one in the comprehensive review of the IFRS for SMEs project. The exposure draft and all of its supporting materials can be found on our website. And the comment period for this exposure draft ends on the 7th of March, 2023. This month, we also had the opportunity to speak to national standard setters at our World Standard Setters Conference. We very much appreciated the opportunity to share what the board is working on, as well as listen to their views and feedback. Recordings of this conference are available on our website. And as always, you can catch up on previous episodes of this and the IFRS Interpretations Committee on our website, as well as our YouTube channel and Spotify. And for the latest developments, please make sure to subscribe on our website. And if you like this podcast, please do take some time to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast player. And remember to tune in next month for the next installment. Thank you so much.
See you next month.